Good morning. My name is Grace, and today we'll be reading Song of Songs, chapter 7, together. How beautiful your sandaled feet, O Prince's daughter! Your graceful legs are like jewels, the work of an artist's hands. Your navel is a rounded goblet that never lacks splendid wine. Your waist is a mound of wheat encircled by lilies. Your breasts are like two fawns, like twin fawns of a gazelle. Your neck is like an ivory tower. Your eyes are the pools of Heshbon by the gate of Bath Rabim. Your nose is like the Tower of Lebanon looking toward Damascus. Your head crowns you like Mount Carmel. Your hair is like royal tapestry. The king is held captive by its tresses. How beautiful you are, and how pleasing, my love, with your delights. Your stature is like that of the palm, and your breasts like clusters of fruit. I said, I will climb the palm tree. I will take hold of its fruit. May your breasts be like clusters of grapes on the vine, the fragrance of your breath like apples, and your mouth like the best wine. May the wine go straight to my beloved, flowing gently over lips and teeth. I belong to my beloved, and his desire is for me. Come, my beloved, let us go to the countryside. Let us spend the night in the villages. Let us go early to the vineyards to see if the vines have budded, if the blossoms have opened, and if the pomegranates are in bloom. There I will give you my love. The mandrakes send out their fragrance, and at our door is every delicacy, both new and old, that I have stored up for you, my beloved.
Well, good morning, friends. It's great to be with you this morning. My name is Nigel. I lead the team here at Christ Church St. Ives, and I get sermons like this one. If you don't know what you're in for this morning, we're in the midst of a series in Song of Songs. And at some point in time, we were going to come to the pointy end of a theology of sex, what the Bible has to say about sex and sexual behavior. And today is the day. If this is your first time with us, welcome. This is not normal. But what is normal is we are a church that wants to take on all the biblical topics, all the things the Bible has to say. All the things the Bible has to say about human experience in all of its parts. We're a church that's unafraid of big and real issues, and we take them on with God's word open. So if you're here today still trying to work Jesus out, if you're here today for the first time trying to work out if this is the place for you, then that's what we want you to know about us, is that we take on the big things with the Bible open. So with all that in mind, here is what I want you to go home with today. It's quite simple. Sex is good, and God created it for the purposes of pleasure, joyful unity, and children. Now, to many of us, that might sound quite pedestrian, but this is crucial biblical truth that we all need to hear, regardless of our marital status, regardless of where we're at in life, regardless of what the state of our life situation is or anything else. Our culture is so confused about sex, but we don't need to be confused about sex because God made it and he told us about it clearly from the very beginning. So Genesis chapter 1, verse 27, very early in the Bible, we read that God created male and female. And then he tells them, be fruitful, increase in number, fill the earth. There's only one way that is going to happen when a man and a woman are standing together. God created us as sexual beings with sexual desires, and he intended for humans to have sex. Now, when I use that word today, I'm speaking ultimately about sexual acts. And I want to say that God did not look down at some point and see Adam and Eve in bed and then freak out. Right? God actually made us and made male and female so you could get in bed together. And when God looked at what he had made, in accordance with his design and purpose, at the end of Genesis chapter 1, when everything is made, God says, wow, this is very good. 1 Timothy chapter 4, verse 4, Paul repeats that. Everything God created is good. Now, I'm laboring this point because I really want you to believe it. The prevailing narrative in our culture is that a Christian view of sex is outdated and morbid and unnatural. In Sydney, sex is a matter of simple freedom. It's a human desire that ought to be fulfilled, however and whenever it is necessary. And into that way of thinking, the usual message people hear from the church is a really shrill, high-pitched no. Too often in the history of the church, even good sex in marriage has been something that we have said very little about. And can I say, in some sense, that's understandable. Who wants to come to church every week and hear this sort of sermon? Not me. But our silence about the goodness of sex and our silence about the goodness of sexual desire has been unhelpful. And it's left a void that actually just creates confused cultural commentary. So I want you to hear this morning. Sex is good, created by God. Your body and all its parts are good. God created sex and gave it as a good gift to human people. But he didn't just hand it over and say, go for it, do what you like. No, God's design for sex springs from what it is and how it works. And as we open the Bible, we see that it has three interconnected purposes. And the first one is for pleasure. And this brings us to the Song of Songs. You can't avoid the reality that these poems beautifully depict the desires and pleasures and yearnings and joys experienced in sex. If anything, this is the unique contribution that the book of Song of Songs actually makes to the whole of the Bible. And I suspect the Edenic language found throughout it is meant to point back to creation and point us back to the goodness of sex and desire on the part of both men and women. I hope that as you've been reading the book, you've seen that just sort of spring up. You sort of feel like as you're reading Song of Songs, I feel like I'm reading an appendix to the early chapters of Song of Songs, and you ought to feel like that. And so the book of Song of Songs opens with these words. Verse 2, let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is more delightful than wine. Pleasing is the fragrance of your perfumes. Your name is like perfume poured out. No wonder the young women love you. Take me away with you. Let us hurry. Let the king bring me into his chamber. And then the whole song ends again with these words at the end of chapter 8, where we read, come away, my beloved, and be like a gazelle or like a young stag on the spice-laden mountains. We had chapter 7 read before, and there you could hear the adoration and the desire being fulfilled. Poignantly, it's expressed in pleasurable desire in and for each other. And throughout the book, you hear this fulfillment of their yearnings, their desires, their love, their hopes, their dreams for their union together. You see, God created sex to be pleasurable. And he made male and female bodies with parts specifically purposed to bring sexual delight. And so in Greg and Amelia Clark's book titled One Flesh, they say, God cares profoundly about our happiness. And one way he's demonstrated this is in making sex potentially pleasurable. Now, what is necessarily striking throughout the Bible is that there is a powerful mutuality in sexual pleasure. It's in the song, it's in Genesis 2, it's in 1 Corinthians 7. Sex is not primarily for a husband, and neither is sex primarily for a wife. Sex is actually for both of you, a husband and a wife, to enjoy together equally. And such should be the concern of both husbands and wives. In fact, in 1 Corinthians 7, Paul encourages married couples to have regular sex. And that alone, I think, points to the fact that sex is for much more than just making babies, which is perhaps what a generation before us, sort of that's all they talked about. But there is a power to it that when unleashed brings delight. And this is at least part of the reason why Song of Songs has that repeated refrain, as we saw in chapter 2, verse 7, daughters of Jerusalem, I charge you by the gazelles, by the does of the field, and equally can I say, the sons of the Jerusalem should be listening to this too. Do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires. And so that leads us to the second interconnected purpose for sex, and it is that it creates a joyful unity. And again, this is captured in the creation narrative in Genesis chapter 2, verse 23 to 25. Let me read to you those verses again. It says, the man said, this is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman, for she was taken out of man. And that is why a man leaves his father and mother and is united to his wife, and they become one flesh. Adam and his wife were both naked, and they felt no shame. See, the difference between a man and a woman provides a profound complementarity that is expressed in a physical union in marriage that builds the deeper personal emotional bond of husband and wife. Notice here in Genesis 2 that the one flesh union takes place after leaving your family to be joined to someone else. And this is just one of the ways that the Bible says time and again that the right location for sexual activity, the place God created sexual activity for, the right place to be having sex is between husband and wife in marriage. Jesus underlines this when he quotes Genesis 2 and then says, what therefore God has joined together, let not man separate. That union that is brought together in marriage is the union where sex is meant to take place. So sex is meant to be so much more than just a personal, pleasurable moment in a casual encounter. In our culture, I think sex has lost the specialness and the dignity and the exclusivity that God designed it for. It's meant to be a mutually beneficial moment that deeply builds a lasting unity and commitment. And you know what? Scientists, as they do sciencey things, no Fortescue's ever studied science after Nikki. She was the only one. And then everyone else just, we got nothing. But when scientists have done sciencey things, this is what they found out. If you Google, you can write this down if you dare, Google oxytocin, eye contact, and sex. And you'll discover some really interesting things. There are some sciencey people smiling going, yeah, that's right. Google it and see. Scientists are discovering the way that even our bodies in their design manifest greater unity through sexual activity. It's quite amazing. Well, there is the third and most obvious purpose of sex, and that is for procreation. Again, from Genesis 1:28, God made us male and female to be sexually complementary so we could be fruitful and increase in number. God designed it that humans would come into the world through this most intimate, loving union, the most intimate, loving union possible, and into the safety and security of that union, the one flesh relationship of husband and wife. Now, of course, not every couple is able to conceive and have children, and nor must a married couple intend with every act of sex to have children. But pregnancy, as a potential outcome of sex, should be acknowledged and embraced with humility and joy. So friends, here is the glory of sex. It's good, and it produces good. God created it to bring pleasure and joyful unity and children, and these are God's three interconnected outcomes of sex. And the fact that they are interconnected points to the reality that sex is a gift for a husband and wife in marriage, their own marriage. And that's the only context in which his purposes can be rightly expressed. So if you do engage in this life-uniting act outside of there, you enter into an intimacy that God intended only for marriage. Now, can I say, I'm not so naive as to think that that's been the case for all of us. I'm not so naive as to think that's the case for all of us right now. Of course, people use sex and have sex and take sex in all manner of different ways because of the powerful immediacy and necessity of pleasure. And it can be overwhelming, and it's meant to be, again, see Song of Songs, That sadly, of course, the wrestle of this means that I've many times spent time with believers who actually envy the freedom of their friends when it comes to sex, or even doubt the goodness of God in placing such a powerful thing just for the context of marriage. And so sex easily becomes a battleground for spiritual faithfulness. The question we need to ask ourselves is, will we hold our desire to honor God as of higher importance than our need to honor our desires? Will we honor God, or will we honor our desires? Now, the natural propensity of every human is to lean away from God. The natural propensity of every human is to lean away from the way that God has designed things, the way that God has structured things, and therefore away from the good in things. And if there is one place that this is clearly seen time and again, it is in sex. And not just in our culture, but in us. And so Deborah Hirsch, in her book Redeeming Sex, says every human being on the planet is sexually broken. When you think about the things that Jesus says, you go, yeah, that's right. It's not just about I haven't committed adultery, it's about what goes on in my heart. And she says all of us are on a journey towards wholeness, and no one of us is excluded. And can I say that that's true for some of us because of the decisions that we've made or the decisions that we make. Others of us, it's true because of the evil of sexual transgression against us. We all need Jesus. We all need to know his comfort and his love and his grace, no matter what your experience of sex has been. The reality is that sin always reaches in and damages everything. And so even in a marriage where you are trying to just hold everything together in beautiful ways, honoring God, most people find at some point that sin makes sex difficult. Our bodies don't always work the way they should. And we make mistakes and use our bodies in ways that don't honor God. We have histories and experiences and expectations that people bring into marriage that make the whole thing hard and awkward and embarrassing. People hurt and shame each other in marriage. And all of this just leads to some of the most difficult things that you can experience in the most intimate, vulnerable, and personal of places. And our experience of life can make God's good gift of sex feel very foreign and very far away. And my guess is that the majority of people here live with some tension between believing that sex is God's good gift and their experience of reality. And bringing some resolution to that is not easy. It takes hard work, sometimes by us, sometimes by others. It requires graciousness, sometimes to ourselves, sometimes from another person. It requires forgiveness, sometimes of ourselves, knowing that God has forgiven us, sometimes of us toward others. And it often requires honest conversation. So again, Amelia Clark writes, "The love poetry of the Song of Songs and the exhortations of the Apostle Paul encourage us to be open, honest, and devoted about sexual love. This may not be easy for some Christian couples for all sorts of reasons of cultural background or personality, but it is a part of marriage that we should not ignore." Now, can I say there's not only sin that reaches in and damages everything when it comes to sex. I think actually anxiety inside the Christian culture and inside our broader culture and inside the church can do the same. Do you know that both in the Victorian era of the 1800s and then what I'll call the purity culture era that began in the late 1970s, unhelpful truths were taught in an attempt to stop people from having the wrong sex? particularly to stop younger people from having the wrong sex. And in both eras, the Victorian era in the 1800s and in the purity culture era starting in the 70s through to perhaps the early 2000s, in both eras, people were told, and I think in some places are still told, things like men have no capacity for self-control. Things like women are largely asexual. Things like women need to be the gatekeepers in all things sex in order to please God, please their husband, and stay faithful. I think they're all really unhelpful things. And if you've heard those things, I want to put on record, they're unhelpful things, untrue things. Weirdly, in the Victorian era, they believed that less sex and a bland diet would keep a man from awakening desire and seeking out prostitutes or pornography. And do you know that Kellogg's cornflakes were created as a bland diet for desperate men? So look, if your spouse comes home with cornflakes, just... Friends, purity culture that some of us grew up in taught that sexual purity was a prime marker of faith. And so remaining so would guarantee incredible sex. If you never touched anyone before you were married, guaranteed you'll have excellent sex. It'll be amazing. And if anything, this just led to constant disappointment. And people were told, if you do anything else, if you do anything wrong in the sexual arena before you get married, God will be disappointed with you and your spouse will be disappointed with you. You can just hear the anxiety in that, can't you? Just sort of like roaming around, people going, just do the right thing and we'll make stuff up to try and make you do the right thing. Now, I really do think both the Victorian era and the purity culture era increased the sexual chaos of the day. And no doubt the thought leaders meant well, but the reality is that both approaches, and you may have thought this and heard this and even utilized this inside your marriage, both approaches have led to shame and damaged marriages and damaged hearts. And many of the things that were taught were untruths, and so we need to stop believing lies and creating false expectations of each other. If anything, in our day, I want to say purity culture and pornography are deadly for a marriage. So how is it that a Christian marriage might get over some of the difficult things? How is it that a Christian marriage might resolve some of the tensions and fears and anxieties inside itself? And where's a place to start? How do we solve these things and flourish sexually? Well, Rachel Joy Welcher, in her book, Talking Back to Purity Culture, says this. She says, by surrendering body and soul to God, the creator and lover of our souls, by praising him with every fibre of our being, soul, mind and body, and by treasuring Jesus himself as the gift, the benefit of life with God. Now, that might sound very generic, like a generic Christian platitude, but it's actually quite profound. Because what she's saying there is that no one cares more about sex and no one cares more about your body and no one cares more about you than God. And there is no one who can be more generous to you and kind to you and forgiving towards you than God. And there's no greater example to follow of love and generosity and service, even in marriage and even in the bedroom, than the Lord Jesus Christ. And if you can take that mindset into sex with your spouse and indeed all of life, then you might just find the freedom and flourishing God designed you for. But we also need to hear God's grace. We need to hear that Jesus shoves no one away. And Jesus welcomes all of us, no matter our history, no matter our past, no matter where we are or where we're up to. I want to read from Hebrews chapter 4, from verse 14. Therefore, since we have a great high priest who has ascended into heaven, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold firmly to the faith we profess. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to empathize with our weaknesses, but we have one who has been tempted in every way just as we are. Yet he did not sin. Let us then approach God's throne of grace with confidence so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need. You know, just thinking about these things might bring forth in some of us guilt or sadness because of the decisions we've made or the things that have happened to us. What I want you to do is to attend the throne of grace. Because it's there that there is hope. It's there we find comfort. It's there we find forgiveness. Whatever need you have, whatever need you're in, whatever grief or pain or suffering or hopelessness you feel, Jesus is ready to listen, ready to show mercy and grace in your time of need. I want to say, what great joy that is. Now, Nikki's been doing some thinking about how to help people into better marriages and better conversation, and she's going to come and share a little reflection with us.
30 years ago, Marge and I got married in this place 30 years ago. We intended to go into full-time ministry back then, but never would I have pictured this day coming. He has a sense of humour. Anyway, most of us by now will have read through the whole book, Song of Songs. It's a book filled with vivid imagery, thrilling and passionate descriptions about mutually satisfying love. Many might wonder, should this be our experience in our marriage? And if only reading it would just replicate it. But that's not the case, is it? As humans created in God's image, sex activity is more than the function, has been created for more than the function of procreation. We have highly developed brains. We have thoughts and feelings before, during, and after our reactions, our physical unions that shape the experience. And God is involved. He unites a couple spiritually. So now this reflection piece that I'm sharing with you today is about the most intimate of activities of a married couple. But I do hope it can be helpful for those who aren't married here today too. It might help you appreciate that this area of marriage can be really profoundly challenging and disappointing. It could give you something to think about if you're going to get married in the future. Perhaps it will shape a conversation that you have with a close friend who's sharing deep struggles with you in this area. So what I've been reflecting on is this. Could the way a couple experiences sexual intimacy actually be a kind of mirror for their relationship as a whole? Does it reflect their love, their faithfulness to their vows? Perhaps even how seriously they are taking their commitment to honour Jesus. Of course, many factors influence this part of marriage. Hormones, young children, work stress, ageing, grief, health, being a carer, fears, emotional baggage. Like, the list is very long as to what is obstacles to a pleasurable and mutually satisfying experience when you're making love. But I think reflecting on the physical union that takes place between a couple can reveal much about the level of communication, trust, and love within the marriage. It's not about whether the couple is experiencing the desire and thrill of we see in Song of Songs. Rather, do they experience the love and safety that we see in Genesis 2? And when Nigel and I meet with engaged couples to help them prepare for marriage, we start with a verse Nigel referred to earlier in Genesis 2. A man leaves his father and mother, is united to his wife, and they become one flesh. Adam and his wife were both naked, and they felt no shame. I find this to be a profoundly moving vision of marriage conveyed in really just a few words. It's a place of, that is safe, intimate, vulnerable, loving, and united. Completely known. Completely exposed, with no fear, no shame, and no embarrassment. So if you're married, is this your experience? For most couples, I would probably say all couples, it's not that the way they experience that. Well, the answer is no, and at least not all of the time. But that is, unfortunately, that's not normal. Marriage is full of ups and downs, including in the area of intimacy. Over the past 20 years of being in ministry, people have shared with me on occasion challenges that they've faced in this area. In an effort to normalise the struggles, I thought I'd share some of these stories. They're from church-going people like you and me. And I've attempted to use the language of Song of Solomon, Song of Songs, to be respectful and discreet. So one friend told me her husband was like Solomon, insisting she join him in his carriage as the duty of a Christian wife. She joined him in his marriage, in his carriage, but felt resentful and unloved. Another friend longed to be with her gazelle, playing in the lilies and drinking wine, but he would not come. Instead, they existed in the wilderness. He did not love the Lord. Their hearts were far from each other, and she looked on him with contempt. Another lady had postnatal depression and three children under four. She was weary and worn, yet for the love of her beloved and for honour to the Almighty, she would open the door to their chambers and kept her feelings to herself. I know one couple who agreed on a day in the week to meet under the apple tree. They'd talked about it, and this was their commitment to each other. Another friend of mine had a husband who said he needed to drink his fill of love every day, sometimes multiple times a day. She poured herself out as oil upon his altar, yet his hunger grew insatiable. Despite her desire to please him, he went and explored other gardens. And I came across another lady who didn't enjoy being in the garden at all. She found her beloved advances distasteful, so over time, he just stopped knocking on her door. They are united in life, but as far as I know, this took place without words. The beloved walked away from the lilies looking forlorn, and their garden became fallow. So I wonder, did any of these stories resonate with you? I wonder what story you might add. Do you think any of these stories fit the Genesis 2 experience of being safe and intimate and vulnerable and loving and united? Completely known and completely exposed with no fear or shame or embarrassment. Can you see how these stories might reveal more about the state of a marriage? What would it look like for each couple to take a step towards the unity God designed for marriage in each situation? And if you are married, what would it take for you to open yourself to seeking that type of connection? So here are a few ideas. Pray. Share your heart with the Lord. Pray for help. Pray for your spouse. And if you are brave, able to brave the vulnerability, pray together. Start a conversation. Acknowledge the silence or the discomfort. Reflect on what might have created these unspoken rules. Be more open. Share a thought you've kept to yourself. Confess and repent. Consider if selfishness, resentment, or hardness of heart has created distance between you and your spouse. Listen to understand. Make space for your spouse to share their feelings, even if they're hard to hear. Lean towards each other with humility and love. learn together, read a book, attend a seminar, or seek wisdom from a therapist. I just want to encourage you to take one step towards each other in love and receive it for what it is, an attempt to build the marriage. And if you find this suggestion just impossible, then perhaps you need to get some more high level, some professional help. The pain and hurt will snowball and it will become harder to resolve. Marriage is a lifelong journey of learning to love each other as God intended, intimately, sacrificially, and joyfully. What's the inevitable outcome if you have downed tools and are not working to love and treasure each other? Finally, let's remember this. No human relationship can fully satisfy our need to be known and loved in our sinful and broken state. Only God can do that. Married or not, each of us is perfectly known, perfectly loved, and completely accepted by Him. And as we relish His love, we can seek to extend the same love to others, not just our spouses. That is an open and generous love as opposed to a sexual love. Can I encourage you to take two steps today? One towards God and one towards each other.
All right, let me make one. I feel like I'm married up, by the way. let me make one final comment, and it is just to dovetail off the back of what Nikki said, and that is to say that we live in a world where people allow sex to define them. I want to say that sex cannot and will not ever define you. Only Jesus can do that. And if you never get married, if you find yourself divorced, if you are widowed, you are no less a human and no less loved by God and no less worthy of the kingdom and of no less a value than the person who is here with the most phenomenal sex life. I think as Christians we need to continue to wrestle sex back into its proper place and recognize that when you trust Jesus, you are loved by the King, you are known by the King, you are treasured by the King. And He awaits your arrival in heaven where delights and joy greater than those ever achievable on earth will be yours. Let me remind you from Hebrews 4. It says, we have a great high priest who has ascended into heaven, Jesus the Son of God. So let us hold firmly, not to sexual identity or not to anything else, but to this, the faith that we profess. Amen.